Grid Lords by Tom Rath.
More episodes are already waiting at patreon.com/TomRath.
The voice you are hearing is generated by AI. Episode 1, Chapter 1. Clive had just blinked, his eyes darting quickly over his shoulder toward Brett, who was in the gleaming, shining workshop. It was the kind of place that belonged in a futuristic sci-fi novel, pristine, orderly, and high-tech. But in the blink of an eye, his world came crashing down. A sudden wave of confusion washed over him, his heart pounding in his chest like a wild animal, desperate to break free from the confines of a cage. Thoughts raced through Clive's mind, each of them vying for his conscious attention. And as quickly as the confusion set in, he realized that he was no longer in the workshop. Instead, he was standing in a room that was a stark contrast to the modern lab he had just left. Carved stone walls enclosed the space on all sides, their uneven surfaces slightly damp from the humidity in the air. The scent of mold and decay filled the room, making it hard for Clive to breathe. Dim light emanated from the corners, where containers of burning oil seemed to be the only source of illumination. The flickering glow from the flames danced on the walls, casting looming shadows that seemed to reach for Clive as he tried to make sense of his surroundings. Toward the far end of the room, he could barely make out a distant, rectangular sliver of daylight that seemed to tease him with the promise of an escape. Clive closed his eyes tightly, willing himself to believe that this was all just a hallucination, maybe a side effect of a stroke, certainly not something that could be real. With his eyes shut, he tried to picture Brett's face, the texture of his beard, and the telling expression of warning that seemed etched permanently on his features. Clive held on to that image, convincing himself that when his eyes opened again, he would be back in the familiar, gleaming workshop, looking at Brett. However, when Clive dared to open his eyes, the same stone room loomed before him, its dim, flickering glow confirming that he was still trapped in this unfamiliar place. Panic began to bubble up inside of him, his breaths coming in short, rapid bursts as he started to hyperventilate. The room seemed to close in on him, the damp smell overwhelming his senses, and Clive felt as if he were drowning in a sea of despair. As the panic continued to mount within him, Clive muttered to himself, "I'm losing my mind. This can't be real. What the fuck could possibly have happened? Oh God, I'm going crazy." The cold, lifeless walls seemed to mock him in his despair, only adding to his sense of isolation and dread. Desperate for any semblance of an explanation, Clive took a closer look at his surroundings. His eyes locked onto the rotting food in ornate bowls scattered about the stone floor, the putrid stench assaulting his nostrils. He shifted his gaze upward to find carvings on the posts supporting the oil burners, their intricate designs hinting at some sort of religious significance. The mysterious, seemingly sacred nature of the space only served to heighten Clive's fears and questions. Where was he? How had he gotten here? Was there any hope of escaping this nightmare? In his desperation, Clive couldn't help but feel a sense of foreboding creep across his heart, casting a dark shadow over any hope he had at finding answers. Gathering every ounce of strength he could muster, Clive closed his eyes once more and took a deep, quivering breath. He repeated to himself, like a mantra, "This isn't real. There's something wrong with my mind. I have to calm down and ground myself." Slowly, he looked down at his clothes, noting the lab coat and ruffled shirt he was wearing. If the room was an illusion, Clive thought, then maybe focusing on something familiar might bring him back to reality. With his heart in his throat, Clive hesitantly raised his head, praying that he would see something, anything, different when his gaze returned to the room. Yet, despite his desperate pleas, the room remained unchanged, the carved stone walls continuing to confine him in this chilling, unfamiliar place. The sense of despair threatened to overwhelm Clive once more, but with a steely determination, he forced himself to remain as calm as possible. Clive stood rooted to the spot, his mind racing as he replayed the last moments he could remember back in the workshop. Brett's worried voice echoed in his head, warning him, "Be careful, Clive. The safety systems are down." Clive had brushed off the concern easily, responding with a touch of arrogance. "Don't worry, Brett. I've done this a million times. Nothing's going to happen." His breathing began to slow a little, still far from normal, but his racing thoughts made it difficult to concentrate on anything else. As he continued to take in the details of the stone room, his ears gradually became attuned to the muffled sounds of human bustle coming from beyond the distant door. The realization that there were people nearby stirred a mixture of hope and anxiety within Clive. While the distant noises seemed to offer a potential escape from his bizarre prison, he couldn't help but wonder who or what he might encounter if he ventured outside the confines of the stone room. Taking a shaky breath, Clive began to move hesitantly toward the door, each step echoing in the cavernous room. As he ventured closer, the sounds outside grew louder, reminiscent of the bustling atmosphere of a crowded shopping mall. His senses were further bombarded by an array of new smells, the unmistakable stench of horse shit mixed with the mouth-watering aroma of cooking meat. Clive tried to make sense of the cacophony of sights, sounds, and scents, but it was simply overwhelming. The situation felt so surreal that Clive couldn't shake the odd feeling as if he were wearing a virtual reality headset, experiencing something that couldn't possibly be real. Nevertheless, the sensations around him seemed all too tangible, leaving him with little choice but to press onward and confront the unknown waiting just beyond the door. As Clive neared the door, the sunlight streaming through it grew more intense, practically blinding him after the dimness of the room he had just left. He squinted, trying to adjust to the brightness, but also eager to catch a glimpse of what awaited him outside. When his vision finally cleared, Clive was bombarded by the sight that unfolded before him. It was a scene seemingly plucked straight from a medieval town or a storybook like Arabian Nights. A dirt street stretched out in front of him, lined with an odd assortment of mud hovels and sturdy stone houses. Market stalls filled with colorful fabrics, exotic spices, and other unfamiliar wares were scattered about, their lively merchants calling out to passersby. Feeling dazed and almost catatonic, Clive took another step, emerging from his stone confinement and out into the open air. The moment his foot hit the large stone step outside the doorway, he was plunged into the hustle and bustle of the strange new world that greeted him. The people around him were dressed in a bizarre mishmash of styles, with some clad in medieval cloaks and robes, while others wore modern attire like blue jeans and t-shirts. Everything felt off-kilter, a disjointed portrait of reality that was difficult to comprehend. Clive's eyes then landed on a piece of meat rotating slowly on a spit over a bed of glowing coals, a sight that would ordinarily seem mundane, yet felt oddly too real amidst the chaotic disarray. Further along, he noticed horses tied to nearby posts, their tails flicking impatiently as they waited for their owners to return. His gaze finally settled on a pair of soldiers, outfitted in shining armor with navy and orange trimmings. The emblem of a white horse was emblazoned boldly on their shields, adding to the surreal tapestry that surrounded Clive. All around him, the world teetered on a precipice between the familiar and the fantastical, leaving him struggling to understand his place in it. "How can this be?" Clive muttered to himself, feeling utterly lost in the sea of contradictions that was his new reality. He incessantly replayed the last moments he spent in the lab, Brett's warning echoing in his head and his own arrogance gnawing at him like a persistent itch. The field generator, could it have been the cause? Clive considered the possibility, but his mind simply couldn't fathom how. The nature of the mistake he had made should have ended his existence. Or so he thought. Not transported him to a world caught between the past and the present. With no other place to go, Clive numbly stepped onto the dirt street, his legs moving almost mechanically, leading him through the strange world without really processing where he was going. He was too preoccupied with the whirlpool of chaotic thoughts and unanswered questions churning within his frenzied mind. As Clive wandered aimlessly, he couldn't help but overhear a conversation between a meat seller and a man in dusty robes. Their voices carried over the background noise, fueled by the intensity of the exchange. The meat seller, seeming weary, said, "Three pieces, sir. That's the final price." The man in dusty robes was unhappy. "Two pieces should be enough. That's what it costs everywhere else." The meat seller seemed unyielding, his voice firm and resolute. "Prices have gone up, sir. I'm afraid it's three pieces for the meat." Looking outraged but ultimately defeated, the man reluctantly handed over the three pieces. The meat seller promptly wrapped the chunk of meat in a piece of flatbread, handing it to the man. As the man in dusty robes took his purchase, he continued to grumble under his breath, "These damn Denver bastards really know how to rob you." Clive's panting grew heavy, seemingly straining to even the score between his rapidly beating heart and his chaotic surroundings. At the mention of Denver in the exchange, his confusion spiked, leaving him reeling with thoughts about how this place could bear any relation to the city he knew. He raised his eyes to take in the full sweep of the scene. A medieval town, but with jarring inconsistencies. Here and there, among the muddy streets and stone buildings, Clive noticed certain features completely out of place. Doors with modern designs, metal accents that belonged to another era, and other elements that simply didn't fit the ancient aesthetic. In the distance, Clive's eyes locked onto a sight that defied explanation, a colossal tower, its design reminiscent of a skyscraper, yet infinitely more unique. Its architecture seemed almost alien, with glowing strips of light running along its sides like veins of energy pulsing through the structure. Whatever this place was, Clive knew it strayed far from the Denver he knew, leaving him with even more questions in his maddening search for answers. The tower didn't just look modern. It looked like something straight out of a science fiction movie. Clive stared at it intently, his mind wandering as he tried to make sense of its existence. Had he seen sketches or blueprints of something similar at a meeting? He couldn't be sure. Distracted by his thoughts, Clive glanced around, only to catch sight of the two guards eyeing him from a distance. Their hands rested warily on the hilts of their swords, as if prepared for any potentially dangerous move Clive might make. He then noticed a man in a flowing, ornate gown, making his way toward the stone doorway Clive had just left, as if it were a place of importance. Further cementing that notion in his mind, Clive couldn't help but think that perhaps the key to understanding his predicament lay somewhere inside that very room. With a renewed sense of urgency, Clive watched the man in the ornate gown, trying to piece together how everything he saw fit together in the perplexing puzzle that was his current reality. Realizing the potential risk of drawing the guard's attention, Clive quickly turned away, doing his best to act casual. As he cautiously walked through the busy market, a young child passed by, shooting him a perplexed glance and exclaiming, "Funny clothes, mister." Confused but unwilling to dwell on the comment, he continued on, coming across a stall displaying a unique array of weapons. Among the medieval swords, bows, and crossbows, he spotted what appeared to be a bulletproof vest. Clive couldn't reconcile the existence of such a modern item in a place that seemed so rooted in the past, deepening his confusion. As he walked further, he overheard the sound of children bickering nearby. Their voices were high-pitched and excited, a familiar scene that somehow felt comforting in the midst of the bizarre environment Clive found himself in. However, their words only served as another reminder of the disconnect between this world and the Denver he knew. Clive decided to listen more closely to the children's discussion, hoping that it might offer some insight into this strange place. The blonde boy said, "Dad says we can't do worse than the Rust Knight. I'm glad he's gone, and I hope we find a better warrior to be the sword." A dirty child countered, "Roland was a great warrior. He won the key in the West when he was the sword in Seattle. It's just bad luck, and battles can be about luck sometimes." The blonde boy snorted dismissively, "Well, Windrake barely won for us. Dad says because of so few flows, the main factories will be shut down. We really need to win this year." A girl chimed in, "Windrake's squire might take the sword." The first boy frowned, "Stormhand would be even worse. Someone better be found at the choosing." Clive listened intently, trying to make sense of their conversation. He found himself utterly confused by the words and concepts they mentioned. The sword, the key, flows, factories, none of them provided a clear answer as to where he was or how it related to his familiar world. Emotions began to well up within him, threatening to spill over as tears, born from the immense frustration and fear of what had happened to him. The only thing holding Clive back from letting his feelings consume him was the residual hope that somehow he might find a solution by understanding the peculiar world he had been thrust into. Suddenly, Clive's train of thought was interrupted by a disturbing commotion. The sound of a man screaming in despair and shock echoed from inside the stone room he had so recently left. His heart raced anew as he stood rooted to the spot, his mind filled with even more questions and concerns about the nature of this mysterious place. Moments later, the ornate robed man reappeared, his face twisted in a mixture of fear and disbelief as he wailed, "The prophet is gone." He continued his mournful cries, his words slicing through the air like an icy knife. "The disappearance of the prophet means doom for us all." Reacting to the alarming cries, the two soldiers who had previously eyed Clive cautiously rushed past the distraught priest and hurriedly entered the stone room. Their weapons were drawn, their expressions tense and determined, leaving Clive to wonder what horrors had unfolded inside the very room he had so recently escaped. With each passing second, Clive's situation grew more perplexing, and his once familiar world seemed more distant than ever before. In the aftermath of the priest's chilling proclamation, the once bustling crowd descended into a mix of anger and fear. Cries and shouts echoed throughout the market square, the people visibly distraught by the news of the missing prophet. Clive noticed the little boy, who had earlier commented on his clothes, trying to engage the weeping priest in conversation. The boy wore an expression of concern mixed with confusion, echoing Clive's own feelings. Meanwhile, the soldiers who had rushed into the stone room emerged pale-faced and visibly shaken. In their eyes, Clive could see a mix of fear and disbelief, further confirming the gravity of the situation. The growing chaos only served to deepen Clive's own turmoil and his desperate desire to understand what had happened to him and how he might find his way back to the world he knew. Suddenly, the priest seemed to pay close attention to the little boy's words. He lifted his head and scanned the crowd in an apparent search for something, or someone. As Clive looked on, the priest's eyes locked onto him, and with a bony finger, the priest pointed directly in his direction. The soldiers, catching sight of the pointed finger, immediately turned their attention to Clive, determination flaring in their eyes as they started to rush towards him. Seeing the approaching soldiers, Clive's instincts took over, and he turned to flee without a second thought. The terror and confusion within him surged like a tidal wave, driving him to escape the mysterious forces that seemed to threaten his very existence. Clive weaved through the labyrinthine streets, his heart pounding in his chest as he desperately tried to put distance between himself and his pursuers. The sound of armored footsteps echoed behind him, a relentless reminder of the danger at his heels. His surroundings passed by in a blur. The mud walls, the ancient stone and glass doors framed in steel clashed discordantly. He barely had time to register each incongruous detail as he fled from the soldiers. Suddenly, Clive found himself on a cobbled street, narrowly avoiding a collision with an odd-looking vehicle. The strange contraption seemed to be a bizarre mixture of an early motor car and a steam-powered train, a fitting representation of the implausible world he was now a part of. As Clive stumbled back from the bizarre vehicle, regaining his footing amidst the commotion, the driver yelled something at him, which only served to disorient him further. Before he could recover, Clive suddenly felt the grip of leather gloves on his shoulders. He was spun around to face one of the guards he had been fleeing from, now standing in front of him, a stern expression on his face. "You're coming with us," the guard announced, his authoritative tone allowing no room for argument or resistance. Clive's heart sank, his newfound sense of terror mingling with the ever-growing puzzle his life had become. Chapter 2. The fuck are we even doing here anyway? If those fuckers would just split up, they could cover all this ground in a tenth the time it will take us. Those three up there are an army on their own. What the hell are we doing risking our lives out here? Nicholas absently listened to the words of his sergeant as he waited. They were both looking at the rise in front of them. Behind him, the murmurs and whispers of 3,000 men filled the air. Nicholas began slowly, trying to keep his voice calm and steady, as he replied to his sergeant. If those three ever strayed too far from one another, the sword would be an easy target for an axe. The enemy knows that, and we both know how crucial the sword is to our success. He wouldn't risk exposing himself like that. Nicholas couldn't help but let his gaze wander up to the three armored figures standing proudly on the rise before them. Their metal armor gleamed menacingly in the sunlight, and the energy that pulsed between the gaps seemed to be a physical reminder of their immense power. The tubes and wires embedded in their armor gave them an otherworldly appearance, and he couldn't shake the feeling that they were more than just mere warriors. They were a force to be reckoned with. The murmurs and whispers of the soldiers behind him only served to strengthen his resolve. Every word spoken a reminder of the human lives that depended on the actions of their small scouting party. They were the eyes and ears of the army, the first line of defense against any threat that could come their way. And they had been tasked with a mission, to scout the surrounding terrain in search of an orb. Nicholas studied the three figures more closely, taking in the orange and black armor that marked them as part of the elite. First, there was Joran Brightforge, the sword, a prodigious young warrior with a giant, energy-pulsing blade strapped to his back. Despite experiencing a string of ill luck over the past year that resulted in few orbs being gathered, the stockpile wasn't yet depleted, thanks in large part to the victories of recent years. Standing close to Joran was Arkstone, the shield. Clad in monstrously bulky armor, it was clear he took his role as protector and leader seriously. The unwavering trust between the sword and the shield was palpable, even from this distance. On the opposite side of Joran stood Jareth Hunter, the arrow. With his lean, finely crafted armor and bladed arms glinting in the light, he was the ideal counterbalance to Arkstone's imposing bulk. Together, Hunter and Brightforge made for a formidable pair, two of the most promising sword and arrow talents in the land. The hopes of the city rested squarely on their shoulders, and they carried the burden with relentless determination. The Sergeant Brian gave a heavy sigh. "I don't know, Colonel. Sometimes I wonder what the point of us being here is. Each of those suits is worth 1,000 men. Meanwhile, we've all got families and work waiting for us back home." Nicholas knew that Brian's words were fueled by fear rather than genuine disdain. In an attempt to reassure his sergeant, Nicholas replied, "Brian, we all play our part in this. There are only 5 suits in our city. They can't be everywhere at once. Our presence here, all 3,000 of us, is enough to make an enemy suit think twice about attacking. We can secure and hold an orb until it's safely collected." Pausing briefly, Nicholas continued, "I've been doing this for a long time, and speaking from experience, men like us rarely see any real action on the battlefield. The suits usually determine the outcomes of these encounters, and there are few who can match our sword and arrow." Brian snorted in response, his lingering fears still gnawing at him, and countered, "If that's the case, then why are we rationing flows again?" The question hung heavy in the air, and Nicholas was forced to admit that he didn't have all the answers. Nicholas adjusted the carbine rifle strapped to his chest, which, while a useful tool in the right circumstances, wasn't something he enjoyed carrying. It felt like unnecessary weight when he considered the odds of actually using it. It was useless this far from an orb. However, he knew that the rifle could be crucial if an orb should land nearby. His hand instinctively returned to the hilt of his sword, a weapon he felt much more comfortable and prepared to wield. "Ill luck played a part, that's true," Nicholas admitted. "Brightforge sustained some damage in the battle with the axe from the Hill Clans last year, and he struggled to make a swift recovery. The sword's presence on the battlefield is crucial. It's around him that the other suit's strategies revolve. This year will be better, though. The lights will shine, and the factories will be churning again soon." Brian nodded, his anxiety still lingering, but tempered with a glimmer of hope. "I sure hope so," he muttered. "My wife's been complaining nonstop about the lack of denims, and we're struggling to find medicine for our youngest. It's easy for those bastards up in the tower. Their lights are always on. It's the little people like us who suffer when the flows run low." As the armored figures began to descend the slope towards Nicholas and Brian, the two soldiers instinctively straightened up, snapping to attention. "Looks like we'll get a chance to see our purpose soon enough," Nicholas whispered. "I think they figured out where to go." As Brightforge approached, his armor hummed with the sound of actuators, and his visor was aglow with energy. His voice, emanating from a speaker on his helmet, carried an air of authority. "Due north, We are detecting something faint. If there's an orb there, it's far away. Start moving in that direction. We'll go on ahead. We'll signal if we need you to hurry. Yes, sir, Nicholas responded immediately, his voice strong and confident. With that, Brightforge turned and rejoined Arkstone and Hunter. All at once, the trio gave a sudden pulse, and they shot forward, racing away at a speed many times faster than any horse could manage. Dirt sprayed in their wake as Nicholas and his men were left to follow, relying on their own strength and determination to guide them towards the potential of a battle and the promise of victory. Brian couldn't help but voice his frustration. If it's so important for us to be there, why not use the glow to bring all of us there faster? Nicholas waved for his men to start moving as he responded. Using the glow to move 3,000 men would be much slower, Brian. Besides, we need to conserve that energy. Remember, if there's an orb out there, we have to be quick about it. The Hill Clans are roaming too, and Thorn Jaxwolf has been sighted. To beat Jaxwolf, we'll need every advantage we can get. At the mere mention of the name, Brian shuddered involuntarily. Damn, I can't even imagine seeing Jaxwolf in person. Nicholas, also fearful but maintaining a brave facade, reminded his sergeant. Brightforge and Hunter are with us, remember? They would surely be a match for even someone like Jaxwolf. With that, the company began their march northward at a brisk pace. I don't know, Brian replied hesitantly. I've heard stories about Jaxwolf. They say he killed the shield from Cleveland just last fall. I've never heard of an axe beating a shield before. A shield's whole purpose is to defeat an axe. The weight of those stories weighed heavily on the minds of Nicholas and his men, but they didn't falter. They knew it was up to them to do their part, no matter the odds. The company of 3,000 men marched steadily through the landscape, a mix of rugged hills and lush forests defining their surroundings. The air was damp with the scent of dew-drenched foliage, and a symphony of birdsong accompanied their journey. Even as they navigated the challenges of the undulating terrain, the soldiers couldn't help but appreciate the natural beauty that surrounded them. In the valleys, they passed rivers that meandered gracefully, their waters teeming with fish and reflecting the vivid blues and greens of the sky and trees. Along the way, they encountered small, tight-knit communities with quaint wooden houses that blended seamlessly into the landscape, their inhabitants watching the soldiers with a mix of awe and trepidation. As the company climbed the sturdier slopes, they were afforded sweeping panoramic views of the countryside. Verdant rolling hills stretched into the distance, punctuated occasionally by stark outcroppings of ancient rock. It was breathtaking, to say the least, and the soldiers couldn't help but feel a deep connection to the land they were fighting to protect. Through it all, the men moved forward as one, their resolve unwavering. The serene beauty of their surroundings belied the darkness shadowing the world, but it also served to remind them of what truly mattered. It was not just a fight for the present, but for the future of their families and the very soul of the land they called home. Suddenly, in the distance, a plume of energy shot into the sky, illuminating the area with a burst of bright light. Nicholas recognized the signal immediately and barked, "Brightforge is calling us. The orb must be there." He turned to face the troops and roared, "Double time!" The soldiers picked up their pace, adrenaline fueling their tired legs as they pushed forward. Brian, panting beside Nicholas, shared his thoughts. "I've never actually seen an orb." Nicholas took a moment to reflect on the fact that it was rare to have a sergeant as inexperienced as Brian, given he had never seen an orb before. However, he reminded himself of Brian's exemplary performance in the skirmishes with the Cleveland forces the year prior, allowing him to climb quickly through the ranks. Despite his greenness, Nicholas had no regrets having Brian by his side in battle. "If you're involved in a battle for an orb," Nicholas explained, "it's usually against other soldiers. It's rare to fight the suits." Brian hesitated, then asked, "Have you ever fought a suit?" Nicholas's eyes grew distant, his mind flickering back to that harrowing day. The titanic fight against the armored warrior who tore through their ranks, leaving a brutal trail of bloodshed, severed limbs, and fear in his wake. The soldiers had fought desperately, some fleeing in terror from the unstoppable force that seemed more like a demon than a man. His voice filled with somber reverence, Nicholas admitted. Yes, once. We lost 600 men and had 300 wounded, but we managed to beat him back. It seems like such a terrible price to pay, but just think of your child needing medicine and the thousands like him back in Cincy. The orb we secured that day kept the ebbs flowing and made a difference in their lives. The soldiers pressed on, climbing a steep rise that overlooked the surrounding landscape. As they ascended, the panorama unfolded before them. Vast, rolling hills carpeted in vibrant green, interspersed with dense patches of woodland. The atmosphere was alive with the chatter of birds and the collective footsteps of 3,000 men marching with purpose and determination. At last, reaching the summit of the rise, they were afforded a view of something truly awe-inspiring. A glowing sphere, almost glassy in its appearance and the size of a horse-drawn wagon. Its ethereal beauty went beyond anything the men had ever seen before, and it seemed almost out of place in the natural world that surrounded it. Nicholas, trying to keep his focus, repeatedly thumbed the safety of his rifle on and off, attempting to gauge by sound alone if the orb was close enough for his weapon to have any effect. Brian's voice held a note of wonder as he said, "My God, that's beautiful." Nicholas nodded in agreement, but quickly returned to the task at hand. That orb holds 100 flows. It could sustain the first sector for quite some time. It would make a big difference. "Let's go get it, then," Brian said with renewed determination. The scene below them suddenly erupted into a whirlwind of action, as the orange and black armored warriors clashed with their brown and black opposites. Each fighter in their powered armor moved with superhuman speed, a blur of force and fury, as gods clashed with gods in a furious ballet of metal and power. The soldiers above looked on in fascination as they realized that the stakes had been raised. Now, it wasn't just an orb they were fighting for, but their very survival. Nicholas remained frozen, his eyes darting around the scene below as he tried to identify the combatants. He could make out Brightforge clashing with another figure that appeared to be another sword. If they were facing Cleveland forces, then it had to be Dahlia Wraithashade, a fearsome warrior in her own right and a possible match for Brightforge. His gaze shifted to Arkstone, the shield, who was engaged in a fierce battle with an axe. The axe, nearly as massive and armored as Arkstone himself, radiated energy as their powerful forms collided. Cleveland's axe was known as Galehart, a figure whose reputation was only slightly less terrifying than that of Jack's Wolf. Although shield suits typically held an advantage over axe suits, Galehart was a force to be reckoned with. Hulkingly enormous and seemingly composed of pure destructive energy, he was one of the rare exceptions who could defy the usual hierarchy of combatants. The soldiers watched in awe and dread as the Battle of Titans unfolded before them, each combatant pushing themselves to their limits in a struggle that would determine the fate of the precious orb and the lives of those fighting for it. Nicholas's attention then turned to Hunter, who was locked in fierce combat with Allura Copperleaf, the Cleveland Arrow. In this matchup, Cincinnati seemed to have a clear advantage. Hunter was potentially one of the most powerful arrows in the land. The two opponents danced around each other, and despite Hunter's undeniable edge in both power and skill, Nicholas knew that a single misstep could quickly turn the tide of the battle. "We need to get into position," Nicholas declared with determination. "Our presence could make a difference. We can help secure our suits, backs, and make the Cleveland bastards think twice about pressing their attack, maybe even force them to back off." Brian looked doubtful as he questioned, "But they're like gods. What can we do against them?" "I've seen it before," Nicholas insisted. "They can't afford to risk themselves too much. The mere presence of 3,000 soldiers can make a difference. The threat we pose might be enough to make them think twice. We don't see a Cleveland army backing them up. These three are isolated. Let's move." With a nod, Brian relayed the command to his troops, roaring, "Move out!" The soldiers sprang into action, adjusting their formation to provide their suits with the advantage Nicholas had devised. Their hearts pounded in their chests, the adrenaline and tension of the unfolding battle stealing their resolve as they prepared to face the challenge of gods. The army surged forward, streaming down the valley toward the orb and the intense battle that raged between Brightforge and Wraithashade. As they grew closer, The soldiers could feel the waves of heat emanating from the clashing, glowing blades of the two swords, the radiant energy intense enough to ignite the grass around them. "Get the second and third order troops to the front as we get closer to the orb," Nicholas instructed Brian, his voice filled with purpose. Brian, though nervous, nodded and replied, "Second order troops, I understand. Do you think the orb is close enough for the third order?" Nicholas clicked the safety of his rifle, confidence ringing in his voice as he confirmed, "It's close enough. She's ready to fire." "No more hesitation," Brian decided, his voice booming as he shouted, "Twos and threes to the front." The second order soldiers, their muskets primed and ready, rushed forward without delay. Meanwhile, the third order troops, armed with automatic rifles and sheathed swords, quickly assumed their new positions. The entire formation seemed to come alive with renewed energy and focus, each soldier fully aware that every move they made from this point on could mean the difference between life and death, victory and defeat. With the orb less than 100 yards away, Nicholas shouldered his rifle and prepared to open fire. Brian echoed the command, ordering the second and third order troops to follow suit. In unison, they aimed and began firing their weapons, sending a torrent of musket balls and bullets streaming toward Wraithashade as Brightforge nimbly danced backward to avoid friendly fire. The hail of projectiles pummeled Wraithashade, causing her to stagger before she redirected her focus toward the oncoming army. Nicholas couldn't help but flinch as he witnessed the godlike figure, now consumed with wrath, making a beeline for them. But just as swiftly as the turn of events transpired, Brightforge's sword struck a phenomenal blow, halting Wraithashade's advance. The force of the strike sent the enemy sword flying through the air, and the resulting shockwave of energy rippling outward from the impact staggered the front line of the army. For a moment, time seemed to slow, and the battlefield fell silent as the soldiers took in the sight of a fallen god. Though her fate was not yet sealed, this small victory sparked a glimmer of hope in the hearts of the Cincinnati troops. In the blink of an eye, the atmosphere on the battlefield shifted. The other two Cleveland suits disengaged their opponents, moving to stand protectively alongside the wounded Wraithashade. It was clear that the mood had changed. The battle seemed to be over, as the opposing forces recognized that pressing on would make little sense. The presence of the 3,000 soldiers had proven to be the pivotal factor. Wraithashade's voice, booming through her helmet speaker, taunted Brightforge. "Are you sure you don't want to see if you can finish me off?" Brightforge's response was swift and confident. "Someday, when I don't have an army by my side, we might get the chance to find out." Wraithashade laughed, though her voice conveyed a hint of sincerity. "I'm looking forward to it." Nearby, Galehart seemed almost restless with anticipation, urging her, "There are only a few thousand men. Just take down one of their suits, and it will balance the playing field for us." Wraithashade shook her head, her voice staunch and resolute. "It's not worth the risk. There are more battles to be fought, and we can't afford to lose one of us here. We need to know when to cut our losses." The standoff between the two groups of warriors, the orange and black painted gods and the Cleveland suits, was palpable. Each bearing the marks and scars from the brief but intense battle, they stared each other down, the air thick with tension and anticipation. After a long moment, Wraithshield turned away from her opponents and, with a pulse of energy, vanished like a demon, a torpedo streaking across the landscape. Copperleaf, not one to be left behind, quickly followed suit. All eyes were now on Galehart, who stood alone, staring down the trio of Cincinnati suits and the 3,000 soldiers behind them. His towering form bristled with power, seeming to loom even larger in the face of the challenge before him. Despite the odds favoring Cincinnati, Nicholas couldn't help but feel a chilling fear take hold as he imagined the carnage the legendary Galehart could cause if he decided to stay and fight. Then, seemingly reluctant to withdraw, but recognizing the necessity of preservation, Galehart turned away from the gathered forces. In an instant, he too propelled himself away across the valley, leaving the victorious Cincinnati soldiers to take possession of the battlefield and the precious orb that had been the cause of it all. The battlefield, once filled with cacophony of clashing metal and anguished cries, now fell eerily silent, It was a silence that stretched thin as anticipation mounted, until, finally, it was Brightforge who broke the tension. "Victory!" he proclaimed, his voice ringing out clear and strong. The effect was immediate. In an instant, the energy of the whole army seemed to shift as the soldiers erupted into whooping cheers, celebrating their hard-won victory. The precious orb, and the undeniable power it held in the form of flows, was now in their hands, secured for their people and their city. In a state of disbelief, Clive sat on the laminate floor, chained to the wall. He couldn't understand the strange paradox that had enveloped his life. Outside the small room was a medieval town, filled with men wielding swords and riding horses, yet here he was in a room with plastic floors and other modern elements. He questioned his reality. Was this some sort of mad dream? Or perhaps he was trapped in a coma, with everything around him nothing more than an elaborate, mind-generated fantasy. As time trickled endlessly, Clive's mind raced, trying to discern the logic hidden within this bizarre world. The saturation of the modern and archaic, the incoherent elements that had woven themselves together into this ambiguous reality, it filled him with an unrelenting, gnawing confusion. Opposite Clive sat an old man with a long beard, also chained to the wall. They had spoken briefly before, but Clive had been too catatonic to make sense of anything. Now, gathering his emotions and deciding to suspend his disbelief at the world around him, he initiated a conversation with the old man. Clive blurted, "What's a sword?" The old man, looking at Clive as though he was a crazy person, replied, "Sharp metal with a handle for chopping folks." Clive, realizing the misunderstanding, repeated and emphasized the word sword in a way that indicated he was talking about a specific use of the word in the context of their strange world. The old man, still looking bemused, responded, "Ah, you mean the suit? What the hell are you talking about? How could you not know what a sword is?" It was apparent that sword held a unique meaning within this world, referring to a specific role or person of importance. Clive knew that understanding this could be the key to unraveling the truth of his bizarre circumstances. Clive, feeling out of place, admitted, "I'm not from around here." The old man commented on his clothes, noticing the peculiar aspects of Clive's appearance. "Your clothes are odd, even your accent. Makes sense if you're a traveler, but where could you be from to not know about the suits?" Clive hesitated before responding, "A long way away." Internally, he reflected on the possibility of being in a different dimension or time or planet, but most likely he thought he was hallucinating or dead. The old man, now suspicious, questioned Clive further. "Whereabouts exactly?" Clive, lying, said, "New York." The old man's incredulity was evident. "There are 10 suits in New York. It's the city with 2 kings. What's wrong with you? Are you hopped up or just plain crazy?" Clive, deflated and barely holding on to his sanity in this strange world, replied, "Maybe I am. But why not humor me? Tell me what a sword is." The old man pondered for a moment, considering his situation. He was chained and had time to spare, so he decided to share the information with Clive. "Old man, you don't know what a suit is? Fair strange. Some folks call them gridlords, that's the proper term. Each city has 5 of them, except for Angel City in New York. Those hellholes are split between 2 states each." Clive, "But what is a suit?" The old man sighed, somewhat suspicious, somewhat annoyed. "A suit is like a god. Only a precious few are chosen to wear them, and it takes a long time for them to learn how to use them after being chosen." This explanation sparked Clive's curiosity. What kind of powers did these suits possess, and why were they of such importance within this world? Despite the pressing dangers of his situation, he was drawn to learn more about the gridlords and the reason behind their mysterious existence. Clive, despite feeling overwhelmed, pressed on, "So what's a sword exactly?" The old man, continuing, but eyeing him like a dangerous spider, said, "Each city has 5 suits, each one different. The sword, the axe, the shield, the arrow, and the scepter. Each suit has different powers and different weaknesses. The axe beats the sword, the shield beats the axe, and so on. It's like rock, paper, scissors, or how water beats fire, and so on." He paused, shaking his head in disbelief, before continuing. "The swords and the scepters have the power to tear down walls, making towns fear them. The sword is special, always the leader of the gridlords within a city. They can channel energy through others. It's hard to believe you don't know about this. Where the hell are you from? Clive, trying to wrap his head around the information, asked, How are the suits chosen? Different cities have different rules. Some people have a natural affinity that make them better gridlords. When an old one is killed or burns out, there's a long process of choosing a replacement. In some cities, politics are involved, so noble sons or politicians get the suit, but those cities struggle. They always need the best person in the suit, whether it's a commoner or a king, it doesn't matter. Clive, remembering the children talking in the square, asked, So is a new sword needed here? Is that the choosing? Our sword, Roland Windrake, was a hero in Seattle. He won many battles in the West and earned many orbs for the city. But politics forced him to leave, and he became the sword in Denver. Things didn't go so well here. Maybe the Rust Knight is over the hill, or maybe it's just bad luck. Roland left Denver and went east. There are rumors he's taken up with the Hill Clans. They're looking for a new sword after Chief Thaddeus burned out. No one is quite sure if Roland is traveling between cities for glory or if there's some other purpose. Clive asked the old man cautiously, What other purpose could Roland have? The old man replied, thoughtful himself, briefly forgetting his suspicions of the madman he was talking with. I'm not sure. Gridlords gain esoteric knowledge when they take up the mantle, knowledge of Vops, the grid, and they often seek artifacts and higher purposes. The Rust Knight was a curious character, and there are many stories about him. Trying to process the information, Clive asked another question. What's an orb? I don't truly know, the old man admitted. But orbs make things work. You see, without orbs, a city just has horses, swords, and muscle power. Except for the tower, that always has electricity and such. But a city without an orb can't use tech. With an orb, they can power up factories, cars, trucks, and even guns. Priests will tell you that it's a gift from the Oracle, and mayhaps it is, but I've got mixed feelings about the priests. Clive froze, struck by shock, as the old man's words resonated deeply within him. He reflected back on his real life, his work, and found a startling connection. So without an orb, there are no guns, nothing digital, and no electric lights? The old man repeated himself, slightly annoyed. That's what I said. Orbs are the power source that sets the level of tech in a city. Some places might have muskets, others just swords, while those better supplied have automatic rifles. If there are enough orbs, a city might even have energy weapons. Most importantly, though, is orbs mean factories, jobs, comforts, and hospitals. A city with enough orbs has all the things that make us little folks happy and healthy and safe. This revelation rattled Clive to his core. The mysterious orbs and their connection to technology seemed to echo the very experiments he had been working on in his own life. Was it possible that this strange world and his work back home were connected somehow? Or was it just another layer of falsehood in an already bewildering illusion? Clive, partly talking to himself, mumbled, Order and entropy fields? Thoughts raced through his mind as he tried to make sense of the connection between this bizarre world and his experiments back home. We were just experimenting. It's too immature. How can it affect so much space? Jesus, are the orbs supplying order fields? Why is everything covered in entropy field? Where or when am I? Desperate for answers, Clive turned to the old man. Do you know what the USA is? The old man nodded solemnly. Do you mean before the fall? Clive froze in place. Yes. What was the fall? The old man's voice grew somber as he explained. The fall was when the Oracle brought mankind low. People were sinners, greedy, destroying the planet, causing the oceans to swell and cities to sink. The Oracle came and took man's power away, leaving him with nothing but sticks and stones. But the Oracle also offered redemption, giving humanity ebbs and flows, the chance to experience the time before the fall. The room fell silent as Clive processed the information, shaking and barely able to believe the coincidences. He and Brett had been working on understanding these fields for their company, merely trying to grasp how they worked. Surely, it couldn't have led to all of this. Clive, eager for more information, asked the old man, What happens if someone tries to fire a gun without orbs around? The old man explained, Mostly, nothing happens. There's a slow burn, but no bang. Sometimes, though, a gun might work, or it might explode and kill you. Clive's thoughts raced back to his work. He remembered performing experiments just like that, intensifying entropy fields to reduce the complexity of the technology surrounding him. The connection between his research on order and entropy fields and the orbs that define the capabilities of this strange world seemed undeniable. As the pieces fell into place, Clive could feel the weight of responsibility and disbelief settling deep within him. Visibly shaking and struggling to accept what he was learning, Clive asked, "When was the fall?" The old man replied pensively, "Nobody knows exactly. Some priests claim it was 700 years ago, others say a million, but most people settle around the 700-year mark." Trying to find some sliver of logic, Clive asked, "How can I be here?" The old man, growing more uneasy and slightly fearful of the seemingly crazed stranger, asked, "Where did you come from? Your accent is strange and you're wearing that white coat. Are you a priest?" Clive hesitated before answering, "I think." He couldn't fully process it all. Memories of testing an order field flooded his mind. The shielding had dropped, and Brett had tried to warn him. But Clive had been overconfident, cocky even, and suddenly he found himself in this strange world. Had he traveled through time? And could he travel back? He didn't think so. Order fields didn't operate like that. The implications of his newfound knowledge were both overwhelming and impossible to comprehend. Chapter 4. As Nicholas marched at the head of the triumphant army, he couldn't help but notice the world around them seemed to blur, almost as if they were moving through time itself. The footfield, an ethereal creation of the enigmatic grid lords, allowed those within its grasp to move at remarkable speeds. The landscape melted around him, and the familiar walls of Cincinnati grew slowly on the horizon. Yet amidst the triumphant return, Nicholas couldn't shake a nagging feeling of shame. The further they marched, the more signs of a struggling civilization came into view. Lush wilderness gave way to plowed fields dotted with weary farmhouses, quaint reminders of the world that had been lost. He watched as a pair of horses strained against the weight of their plow, and the sight filled him with dismay. If only they had secured more victories in the previous year, perhaps this fondly remembered world would still be within their grasp. The promise of the past, a time where machines took on the burden of the work, so humans could turn their eyes to the stars, seemed to grow dimmer with each passing day. Steeling himself, Nicholas silently vowed to work harder and achieve greater success in the year to come. He was determined to rebuild the world he remembered and fight for a future where tractors would once again render the horses efforts unnecessary, a world where humanity could flourish and overcome the shadows that threatened to consume them all. As he approached the gates of Cincinnati, those towering bulwarks of hope and defiance, Nicholas let the determination kindle within him a spark of renewed purpose. This victory would not be their last, and he would do everything in his power to ensure their continued success in the battles to come. "We'll be given a hero's welcome for sure," Brian said, his eyes gleaming with an excitement that was infectiously contagious. "A wild orb is such a prize. They'll throw us feasts, the factories will roar with life again. There'll be work and trade and medicine for my lad at home." He shifted in his stride, but still held on to the lyrical roll of words. "We'll be going to the sanctum, they say. I've heard so much about it. It's luxuries and wonders, and yet I've never experienced it." Nicholas sighed, his previous resolve subjected to Brian's starry-eyed dreams. I've been feasted there a few times," he reluctantly admitted. "It's true. The sanctum does hold wonders, the lights that never dim, the ice cream as cold as winter, and the screens with endless entertainment. But at the same time, it never truly felt like my place. I couldn't shake the feeling I was amongst my betters," he added bitterly, "always looked down upon. I was treated less like a soldier being celebrated and more like a dumb pet being rewarded with a treat." Brian's face took on an edge, his voice scornful as he replied, "Don't be so dark, Nicholas. You should learn to enjoy a treat when you can get it. Life doesn't offer many luxuries to the likes of us." Nicholas merely nodded, offering no other words to fuel the conversation. With the same silence that had enveloped them before, the two men continued their march towards the city. They walked within the footfield as it blurred past farmhouses and stretched landscapes, distorting the world in subtle ways. To those outside the field, the army would seem to move at the steady pace of a galloping horse, perhaps even faster, all thanks to the Gridlord's mysterious gift. As the city walls grew closer and closer, Nicholas knew deep within him that their forthcoming celebrations would not overshadow the ongoing struggle of the world. Brian's gaze shifted to Brightforge, who marched proudly ahead of them, his body radiating the soft shimmer of absorbed flows from the orb. "It's truly a sight to behold, how they glow like that, full of power and promise," he said, his voice laced with admiration. Nicholas nodded in agreement. "Each of them now holds a lifetime's fortune in flows." "It's incredible." Brian's expression softened as he considered the implications. "I understand better now the importance of simple soldiers like us. The suits, powerful as they are, become so vulnerable while absorbing the flows. They desperately need support during that time." "That's why they slow themselves down with an army to back them up," Nicholas added thoughtfully. "The Gridlords can move many times faster when the footfield covers them alone. But they're willing to sacrifice some of their speed to keep us close, knowing that a few thousand men are critical for their defense." As they marched within the footfield, the pair felt a deeper appreciation for their role in the grand scheme of things, a unique bond formed not only between themselves, but also with the suits they supported. Together, they were an unstoppable force, fighting for the future of their city, their world, and the generations yet to come. Nicholas couldn't help but shudder as he remembered a harrowing event from the past. The memory of a rogue suit cutting through their ranks was still vivid in his mind. "When they're attacking, they're like demons, so strong and fast and nearly invincible," he said, his voice barely more than a whisper. As the memory played out in his mind, he recalled the devastating effects the suit's shield had inflicted on them that day. After a moment's pause, Nicholas continued, "They know their own value. A single spear or bullet, aimed precisely or fired at just the right moment, can kill or incapacitate them. And even a minor injury to one Gridlord could weaken their city immeasurably. They simply can't afford to take risks like that or endanger their fellow suits and people." He took a breath, the dark memories slowly receding as he shifted his thoughts to the present. "We were fortunate this time to get close enough to the orb to benefit from the field, enabling us to fire higher-level weapons. That alone was much more intimidating to them than anything we could do otherwise." As they marched on, the realization of the delicate balance between suits and soldiers settled within them, each understanding how vital the other was to their mutual survival and success. Brian shivered at the thought. Watching Wraithashield take a barrage of bullets while barely flinching, it's hard to imagine how they could even care about our little army at all. Nicholas nodded, appreciating Brian's sentiment, but choosing to provide a different perspective. "You'd be surprised. Each individual bullet might be nothing but a gnat to a suit, but enough gnats can become an annoyance, even cause pain or death. An army of 3,000 men might actually be enough to bring down a suit in most cases, depending on the Gridlord inside, of course." His voice grew solemn as he added, "That is, if you can somehow keep the men from fleeing in terror as they watch their comrades on the front lines turned into red mist." Brian's voice wavered as he gulped. "Well, the campaign season is still a long way off. Until then, I can only hope that I'll only cross swords with other men on the battlefield, or even better, not have to cross swords at all." He managed a weak smile as he tried to focus on the immediate future. "And in the meantime, I can't wait for that feast and the chance to finally taste real ice cream." Nicholas shared in Brian's growing anticipation, his own eyes lighting up at the prospect of the upcoming festivities. A sumptuous feast, luxurious amenities, and delicious ice cream to celebrate their hard-earned victory. It was a well-deserved reward for the countless sacrifices they had made and the challenges yet to come. Brian's expression softened as he considered the implications. "I understand better now the importance of simple soldiers like us. The suits, powerful as they are, become so vulnerable while absorbing the flows. They desperately need support during that time." "That's why they slow themselves down with an army to back them up," Nicholas added thoughtfully. "The Gridlords can move many times faster when the footfield covers them alone, but they're willing to sacrifice some of their speed to keep us close, knowing that a few thousand men are critical for their defense. As they marched within the footfield, the pair felt a deeper appreciation for their role in the grand scheme of things, a unique bond formed not only between themselves, but also with the suits they supported. Together, they were an unstoppable force, fighting for the future of their city, their world, and the generations yet to come. Nicholas couldn't help but shudder as he remembered a harrowing event from the past. The memory of a rogue suit cutting through their ranks was still vivid in his mind. When they're attacking, they're like demons, so strong and fast and nearly invincible, he said, his voice barely more than a whisper. As the memory played out in his mind, he recalled the devastating effects the suit's shield had inflicted on them that day. After a moment's pause, Nicholas continued, "They know their own value. A single spear or bullet, aimed precisely or fired at just the right moment, can kill or incapacitate them. And even a minor injury to one gridlord could weaken their city immeasurably. They simply can't afford to take risks like that or endanger their fellow suits and people." He took a breath, the dark memories slowly receding as he shifted his thoughts to the present. "We were fortunate this time to get close enough to the orb to benefit from the field, enabling us to fire higher-level weapons. That alone was much more intimidating to them than anything we could do otherwise." As they marched on, the realization of the delicate balance between suits and soldiers settled within them, each understanding how vital the other was to their mutual survival and success. Brian shivered at the thought. Watching Wraithashield take a barrage of bullets while barely flinching, it's hard to imagine how they could even care about our little army at all. Nicholas nodded, appreciating Brian's sentiment, but choosing to provide a different perspective. "You'd be surprised. Each individual bullet might be nothing but a gnat to a suit, but enough gnats can become an annoyance, even cause pain or death. An army of 3,000 men might actually be enough to bring down a suit in most cases, depending on the gridlord inside, of course." His voice grew solemn as he added, "That is, if you can somehow keep the men from fleeing in terror as they watch their comrades on the front lines turned into red mist." Brian's voice wavered as he gulped. "Well, the campaign season is still a long way off. Until then, I can only hope that I'll only cross swords with other men on the battlefield, or, even better, not have to cross swords at all." He managed a weak smile as he tried to focus on the immediate future. "And in the meantime, I can't wait for that feast and the chance to finally taste real ice cream." Nicholas shared in Brian's growing anticipation, his own eyes lighting up at the prospect of the upcoming festivities. A sumptuous feast, luxurious amenities, and delicious ice cream to celebrate their hard-earned victory. It was a well-deserved reward for the countless sacrifices they had made and the challenges yet to come. The guards came to a halt before Jarway and Cephalus, their duty now solely to guard and watch over this new, mysterious man. Under normal circumstances, they would have knelt in reverence, but today was far from normal. When Clive failed to appropriately kneel, one of the guards shoved him, prompting him to quickly understand his current situation. Clive attempted to show respect, remaining still and keeping his head down. Jarway scrutinized him and began talking. "Reports say that you were the last person seen before our prophet disappeared. It is a grave day for Denver. Today was supposed to be a feast day in honor of the prophet, a market day for the people. Instead, they are gripped by panic and fear." Clive raised his head and eventually found the courage to stand, struggling for words, mumbling in response. Jarway, adopting a firmer tone, insisted the man explain himself. "Who are you, and what are you doing here? You have a strange accent, and your clothes are unusual. Are you some kind of priest or a missionary?" Clive started to find his footing, though fear and confusion still weighed down his voice. Clive, still nervous and confused, hesitantly began to speak. "I don't know when or where I am exactly. I'm just a lab tech working on a project, and suddenly I found myself here. I don't know anything about this prophet you speak of." Jarway responded firmly, his curiosity piqued. "What do you mean by lab tech?" Clive tried to explain. "A lab tech, short for laboratory technician, is someone who works in a scientific laboratory, conducting experiments and research." Jarway didn't fully understand, but he had a vague sense that this man might be associated with arcane knowledge or advanced technology. Growing more interested in Clive, Jarway inquired, "What is your name, stranger?" Clive continued, his expression and eyes still giving the impression of a madman. "My name is Clive. I don't know what's happening or who any of these people are. I'm so confused. I just want to go home, if I'm not just hallucinating all of this." Jarway, although not following much of Clive's explanation, asked, "And where exactly are you from?" Clive replied, "Denver, but not a Denver like this. My Denver has cars and skyscrapers, no swords, no prophets." Overwhelmed, Clive started to sob and hyperventilate. Jarway, unimpressed with Clive's display of distress but intrigued by his words, considered the possibility that this man might be describing the world before the fall. As he pondered this, a guard approached Jarway, handing him a small sack. The guard explained, "M'lord, these are the items we confiscated from the prisoner." Jarway inspected the items in the sack, finding them quite peculiar. In time, he recognized one as a flashlight, although its craftsmanship was unlike anything he had seen. Curious, he asked Clive, "Where did you acquire such a fine item?" Clive replied, still dazed, "Best Buy." Jarway furrowed his brow. "What is Best Buy?" Clive tried to explain. "Best Buy is, it's a store where you can buy all sorts of electronic items and gadgets. It's a place in my world where these kinds of things are common." Jarway began to understand some of what Clive said, intrigued by the notion of acquiring treasures like these. "And where might I find this Best Buy?" he asked. Clive, breaking down further, sobbed, It's supposed to be right here, just a few blocks from the temple." Jarway continued to examine the items in the sack, producing a black, shiny slate about the size of his hand with buttons on the side. He pressed one of the buttons, and the screen lit up. While he had seen screens before, a handheld one like this was extremely rare. He looked back at Clive. "What is this?" Clive attempted to explain. "This is my phone. It's called a smartphone." Seeing Jarway's confused expression, Clive tried to clarify further. "You see, a smartphone is a device in my world that serves multiple purposes. It's primarily a communication tool, allowing us to call or send messages to people, no matter their location. But it's so much more than that." He continued passionately. "A smartphone has a little computer inside that can perform many tasks. We can access something called the internet, which gives us information about almost everything we can imagine. It helps us navigate our way through cities, find places to eat, shop, and even entertain ourselves. We use it to take photos and videos, listen to music, and even play games. A smartphone is a small, powerful device that connects us to everything around us." Jarway could barely grasp the concept of a smartphone as Clive explained its many functions. He continued to poke at the screen, marveling at how it responded to his touch. Setting the phone aside, he picked up a multi-tool and figured out its functions, admiring the craftsmanship. After setting it aside, he was struck with awe upon seeing car keys. Jarway had seen car keys before in a museum, a relic from the before, but these were new-looking, not the crumbling relics he was familiar with. Shaking slightly, he asked Clive, "What are these?" Clive named them and went on to explain, "These are car keys. In my world, they are used to unlock and start a car. It's a vehicle for transportation. Cars have engines that run on fuel, and they can travel great distances at high speeds. They're a common means of transportation, allowing people to move around their cities and even travel across the country." Jarway was aware of the concept of cars. They did have some functioning in areas of high order, but these areas were limited at the moment. His suspicion grew, as the man seemed to be from the before, yet that was impossible. Jarway wondered whether Clive might be genuine or just a trickster. Determined to uncover the truth, Jarway probed Clive, "Where are you really from?" Clive, breaking down further, recounted his experiences. "I was working in my lab, testing a field. I ignored the safety precautions like a cocky idiot. Brett warned me, but I didn't listen. Then suddenly, in a blink, I found myself standing in a strange stone room. When I ventured outside, it was madness. No cars, no blacktop, just dust, mud houses, swords, and horses. I couldn't understand what happened." His voice grew more desperate. "And then I was brought here to this tower, where there are electric lights and air conditioning. I fear I'm losing my mind." The details in Clive's story and his undeniable distress gave Elder Jarway reason to consider the possibility that he was, in fact, telling the truth. Jarway understood that the idea was incredibly unlikely. But if this man truly was from the before, he might possess knowledge that could change the course of battles, help them gain control of the orbs, and possibly even secure the empire they so desperately sought. Jarway cautiously approached Clive. "I am intrigued by you, but you are in no state to continue this conversation. In tears and babbling like a child, I suggest you rest now. I'll have my attendants help you relax and settle in, and we can talk further tomorrow."
New episodes every Friday, with newer episodes always waiting for Gridlords on Patreon.